Welcome to We Talk Comics, a special interview with Fred Van Lente, the writer of the newly or almost to be released Magnus, as well as Brain Boy from Dark Horse, and of course, our personal, one of our personal favorites, Archer and Armstrong from Valiant. Fred, how are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me, guys.
Well, no problem. Of course, that's Brett there. He didn't introduce himself.
Yeah.
You know, but that's Brett.
Hi, Brett.
No, but nobody cares about me.
That's true.
I'm just secondary to this process.
I'm Mo, but Fred is the reason we're all here to talk to you, sir. Again, I appreciate you giving us the time. So let's go through here and open it up. I've looked into your bibliography a little bit and your history. So if you don't mind, you were born in Tacoma, Washington, is that correct?
I was. My father was in the Army at the time, and there's a U.S. Army base there, Fort Lewis, and I was born there.
Oh, cool. So when was comic books, when did they start kind of to merge for you as one of your favorite art forms?
Very early on. My dad was a casual comics reader, and so when I was very young, he gave me his copy of Jules Feiffer's book, The Great Comic Book Heroes, which is this expansion of an essay. Feiffer, who, as many people know, was Will Eisner's assistant, went on to be a very famous Pulitzer Prize-winning editorial cartoonist and a pioneer of the graphic novel for The Village Voice. He gave me that book, and that book had this essay that Feiffer wrote, and then had a lot of reprints of a lot of the Golden Age comics, so your Batman, your Superman, your Timely Era, Human Torch, Captain America, and Submariner. So I really started with comics when comics started, or at least when superheroes started, fairly early on, and they really helped me to read at a young age.
That's true, actually. I think that's one of the things that people don't realize enough about comic books is how much they can actually help somebody who's young become an advanced reader for later in life.
Right.
So you've become a comic book fan now. Are you still living in Tacoma, or do you move out? Where do you live now?
No, we were talking earlier about conventions before we went live, but I'm excited for going to Emerson Comic Con because this will be the first time I've set foot in the state of Washington since I was about 6 months old.
Wow.
When my dad left the Army and I got carried off and headed east. So, I'm very excited to return to my birth state. And I've never been to Seattle, so I'm really looking forward to it. No, I spent my childhood between New Jersey, where my dad got his degree in biochemistry at Princeton. And then I grew up primarily in Ohio. My dad was the head of pathology for the Cleveland Clinic, which is a pretty well-known hospital here in the States. And then I went to school at Syracuse, and then for most of that period after that, I've lived here in New York City.
So your father obviously sounds like a very educated man. You say to him, Dad, I want to write comic books. What does he say?
Right. Oh, they hated it. They wanted me to be a scholar. They wanted me to be an English professor. And so I went to a year. I went for a year to the University of Pittsburgh to study English literature. I had a very nice time, but we sold... My buddy Steve Ellis and I sold a series to Malibu Comics. For those of you listening who remember Malibu Comics, it's another Valiant era company, right? So I was like, this comics thing is easy. So I dropped out of school and I moved east to New York where Steve was living. But then Marvel shut down Malibu and I didn't really get much by the way of mainstream comics work for like 8 years after that.
Is it Negative Burn? Is that where your first book was published? Yeah.
That's a good question, whether it was Negative Burn. It might have been Negative. Yeah, I think you're right. I think it was Negative Burn.
Again, I was doing a little research on you. I think it might have been, Negative Burn. I can't remember the title.
Steve Ellis and I, that was a series we did called Tranquility.
That's
that
right.
Was a science fiction series. That got optioned by an outfit called Platinum Studios, and that led me in 2001 to write Cowboys and Aliens for that.
Ah, excellent, excellent. Now, Cowboys and Aliens, of course, became a major motion picture. Were you on set? Do you get a chance to visit? I mean, you were licensed to write for them, or was it your concept?
Right.
Or
no, the Platinum, and I don't think I'll be shocking you by saying this, is what is known in the business as an IP farm, an intellectual property farm. Like I wrote this comic in 2001. They didn't publish it until 2006. I think the only reason anybody knows that I wrote it is that by totally unrelated circumstance, I kind of got a name in comics anyway before the comic came out. So they did all they could to sort of erase any trace of the actual comic from the movie. The people at Platinum are not the most well-respected individuals in either comics or movies, and the sheer number of lawsuits leveled at them. In fact, my co-writer from Cowboys and Aliens is Calgary's own Andrew Foley.
Yeah, that's what I was going to talk about, because we've got a lot of those folks. I actually was at a signing with them just last year. But
lovely. But yeah. Well, he's a lovely bloke.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very much so.
None of the subsequent unpleasantness had anything to do with him.
So what was the workflow like then on that? Because obviously you're nowhere near the same place, but Andrew was close to some of the people that worked on the art and such.
What do you mean workflow?
Well, just for like how you wrote it with him and stuff like
that. I didn't. Oh, okay. I wrote a script in 2001, and then he rewrote it in, gosh, you'd have to ask him. It was probably, I would guess, but Andrew would know for sure it was 04, 05 or something like that, and the book finally came out.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Might have been 07, I don't remember. But yeah, no, they made sure to cut me out entirely of the process. The issue was that I initially wrote this script that was very, I guess, for lack of a better word, fun, which is...
Oh, no.
What I know, right? Which, unfortunately, in our field is frequently a pejorative. You know, the trouble with getting Cowboys and Aliens, the movie, off the ground was always the Will Smith bomb, Wild Wild West,
mm-hmm.
which is another sort of very jokey kind of pseudo science fiction-y kind of Western. And so they hired Andrew, and I know this because Andrew told me this, just sort of stripped the humor out of the script. And they sort of tweaked some stuff and took what I was sort of writing as kind of a PG-13 kind of family film, skewing more PG, and they wanted it to be more of a sort of a special effects kind of testosterone-fueled action movie. Closer towards the R range of PG-13. That's, I think, more of the movie that they ended up making. I, you know, like a lot of things in comics, I didn't really understand how anyone could take anything called Cowboys and Aliens all that seriously. And, you know,
makes
and sense. I felt somewhat vindicated when the movie came out and the Smurfs just wiped the floor with them.
Yeah.
You know, the Smurfs, for God's sakes. I mean, if you can't get much more family friendly than that. You know, the whole process was kind of hilarious just because, you know, I got so many convention invitations when that movie, you know, when the movie came out, and I certainly got a lot of press on me. And I've taken every opportunity to say I don't particularly like the movie, but it's just a bizarre situation, you know, where this movie was made out of my book, my book that was rewritten by this dude from Calgary, and it's just a bizarre thing to sort of be associated with. But, you know, it for God's sakes, it impresses people. If you've made a movie, you can say, if you knew you can say that, and it's true, is you have one up on everybody else kind of clawing and fighting their way through the entertainment field, you know?
It makes you feel any better. I never saw the damn thing.
Well, I saw it on HBO, and I had to get really drunk after.
I did see
it. It has seven credited writers, so just think about
that. Oh, yeah, no.
It's at 20.
It feels like it has seven credited writers, yeah.
Yeah.
It's hard. It takes effort to make a movie called Cowboys and Aliens with no humor in it. I don't quite know how that happened, but like I said, they didn't ask me, so it's none of my business.
Good enough.
All right, let's move on here. So I think 2003, you come up with The Silencers. Is that correct?
Yes.
So that's where you say you have. What is the time between, you know, what, around 96, 95, and 2003? With what are you doing with your life? You don't have
temping.
Pardon me?
Mostly temping, occasionally working. I wrote about 8 books for Platinum Studios, of which they eventually published via Top Cow. Gosh, counting Cowboys and Aliens, I'd say they published about 4 of them. Fun trivia, one of them was was the first professional work of Brian Shirella, who's a terrific writer-artist who did a great book for Oni called The Secret Life of D.B. Cooper, which is wonderful. Scott Koblish, who now draws Deadpool, did a book called The Weapon that we were super proud of, and that was one of his first sort of big professional gigs as a penciler, at least. He was before Deadpool, he was known primarily as George Perez's personal inker for many years. And a lot of temping. I did the Tranquility, the science fiction book. And then we did The Silencers, which was unexpectedly very beloved. That was the series we actually sold to Malibu. But we retain the rights as part of Malibu's kind of crazy meltdown. It was recently confirmed to me by sources within Marvel that no one will ever see the Malibu characters ever again. So I'm sorry if I'm disappointing.
That's, really?
Sorry if I'm disappointing any Ultraverse fans out there.
No, Prime, no Sludge. Are you kidding me?
It's funny because in our podcast travels, we actually have become friends with some of the Malibu higher ups and such, and so we did an entire Malibu podcast. And
my first big two book, and this would be the question, is whether or not this came out before Negative Burn. I think it might have. Is I did a fill-in issue of the second series of Prime.
Hmm. Okay.
And I was credited as Jan Van Lente, which is my middle name, is Jan.
Uh-huh.
Going through a bit of a directly post-college identity crisis.
I love Prime.
How I wanted to. You know, he was a fine character, except he can't be knocked out, which I just think is a moronic, you know, like, they were like, you can't be knocked out, because then he turns back.
And here's the thing, I'm my all-time favorite character, Captain Marvel, Shazam, and he's, you know, it's kind of the...
he's a nice analog of that, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's probably my and then Sludge is just cool. I don't care what nobody says.
You mean the Man Thing analog?
Yeah, exactly. I don't care though.
Yes, we know they're all analogs,
but we don't care. We love those guys. Talked to Chris Ulma quite extensively in the past.
Well, you can't beat Mike Klug, and that was Sludge was one of the good ones. Well, that was where the pumpkin character
came from. Yeah.
That was the most memorable of the Malibu characters.
It is too.
Now everyone's turned off this podcast because we're going on about Malibu characters.
All right, so let's bring them back in. So Marvel, now you started writing a lot of books. It seemed like almost every book from Marvel. So what brought you into Marvel?
The Silencers did. Steve Ellis, the artist, gave Mark Panicia Silencers at the at a convention, and he really dug it, and he invited me to pitch for Amazing Fantasy, which they brought back as sort of a pseudo anthology series over at Marvel, and that's how I got in, and I did some obscure stuff. I talked my way into doing this Moto X11, the supervillain team up book. That was sort of this fun anomaly over there. And then I did the kids' books for about a year and a half, about 2 years. I was doing Marvel Adventures. I originated Marvel Adventures Iron Man, and then I did the Spider-Man, and I did the Fantastic Four books. I did a book called Wolverine First Class that was the Wolverine kids' book. Like, I always felt like they came to me with these suicide missions. Like, like, you're going to do Wolverine ongoing. Great, except it's a kids' book. What? And then they came to me and they were like, I want to do supervillain team up. And I was like, well, we can't get, and I asked for Sabretooth and Dr. Doom and Green Goblin and whoever. And like, we'll give you MODOK. And I was like, all right. So I had to turn around and do the whole thing around MODOK. And then they came to me and they said, we would like you to co-write Hulk with Greg Pak. And I said, that's awesome. And they said, well, except Hercules is going to be in it. And I was like, what the fuck are you talking about? And then that became Incredible Hercules, and that's sort of what sort of put me over the top in terms of my cred.
Yeah, if you prove that you can write Incredible Hercules, then you've proven that you can write anything.
Sure.
You know, the thing is, Incredible Hercules is actually quite, I mean, the sales were very good. And you know, popularity.
We took over the Hulk's book when Hulk was at the height of its popularity, which didn't hurt.
Around the World War.
Here's a funny story, we'll get into this later. The funny story is that, Tom Brevoort told me this story a couple years ago where when they were talking about doing Incredible Hercules, which was this team up between Hercules and Amadeus Cho, is they were trying to figure out whether that would work. And Tom goes, well, yeah, it'll be just like Archer and Armstrong. Because he was a big Archer and Armstrong fan from original Valiant. And so, you know, I never knew about this. And then when the new Valiant approached me about doing Archer and Armstrong, I was like, what? What is our? I've never even heard of that, you know? So I had to Google it, and then I was like, oh, okay, I can see why they wanted me to do this. So it's one of the weird circle of life things where I had no idea that Archer and Armstrong contributed to the existence of Incredible Hercules, which then contributed to me bringing back Archer and Armstrong. So go figure that out.
I can't. You just blew my mind. It hurts a little.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's okay.
Blew mine. Certainly blew mine.
That's all right. So you're working with Marvel. That actually kind of brings up the question of, kind of looking at it, you're working with that many series. Is they're coming to you with those series? Or are you going to them with ideas? Or how is kind of the process at the time of Marvel there?
Supervillain team up was my idea. Well, I mean, comics in general have become just very editorially controlled. And I think that's true whether you're talking about Marvel or DC, even if you're talking about some of the smaller companies. Like I said, I brought Supervillain Team Up. I wanted to do a Supervillain Team Up book, and partly just because they hired me because of the Silencers. So I figured, and the Silencers, I guess I should mention this. I should plug the Silencers, I suppose. The Silencers is a series that Steve Ellis and I did about a team of superpowered mob enforcers who have to become independent operators when the mob family they work for gets wiped out. And the Silencers is coming back this year. All of our stories, including the Image series, is going to be collected by Dark Horse.
Nice.
A great trade that's coming out, I want to say, in October of this year. So look for that, kids. So I wanted to do Supergirl Team Up, but they wouldn't let me use anybody, you know. We wanted to do Hulk, but they wouldn't let us use Hercules. You know, they made us use Hercules. Almost, I'm trying to think what became, if I don't know if you guys are familiar with X-Men Noir. That started out as a separate pitch about the Angel, the Golden Age Angel. Dennis Calero and I wanted to do a series called Marvel Mystery Comics, where the reader had to kind of figure out the mystery by the end of it. Like, Marvel Mystery Comics was Marvel's, was Timely's big title in the 40s, so we're trying to sort of bring that back. So most of the stuff that I did at Marvel, and you'll find I think that's largely true with pretty much every book, is all generated internally with the editors. So really, X-Men Noir and MODOK 11 are the two books that I did that were initially my pitches, but then they got mutated into something totally different.
And you created the new Power Man, though. Was that part of the... They come to you and say, oh, we're doing Shadowland, we want a new Power Man, we...
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah?
That's interesting, because after reading it, I would have pegged you as like a big Power Man and Iron Fist fan.
I wasn't. I like her. I didn't know anything about Hercules, either the mythological Hercules or the Marvel Hercules, until they wanted me to do Hercules. But I loved the... Iron Man... Iron Fist is terrible. I'm just going to come out and say this. Iron Fist is a terrible character. He is one of a long line of white guys who get Asian powers, which I just find very bizarre and it started with the Shadow and it goes all the way down to Iron Fist. But his book was terrible. Power Man's book is fucking awesome. And it's amazing. And if you ever get a chance, read particularly the George Tuska and Billy Graham drawn issues of Power Man. It's freaking amazing.
Back at the beginning for the first
time. Yeah, right. Technically, it's called Hero for Hire.
Exactly. I'm a big fan too. So,
well, we got they got.
If you read the whole run, then he gets saddled with fucking Iron Fist. Power Man Iron Fist was a fine comic. To me, it was nowhere as good as Hero for Hire. And Iron Fist solo comic was always terrible. Because Chris Claremont wrote it, it was like Chris Claremont doing his X-Men shtick of having 100 different storylines that never resolved, ever.
Yeah, that's true. I think it's like the third
Somehow he managed to do it with only one character, which just seems completely insane to me. I don't know how he managed to accomplish that. I was not a big fan. they initially wanted Power Man to be like a 12-year-old kid.
It's not Power Man anymore, then. Is it a little irony there, or?
Well, they thought it'd be hilarious to have some little kid saying, I'm Power Man, and smashing things, I assuming in some kind of like Ebonics accent, and I was like, whoa, I'm not going anywhere near that. So I somehow managed to talk them into doing this other character. Because Ed and Matt in their Immortal Iron Fist book, they had Danny was had a dojo and was teaching kids. The initial idea that they were having was Power Man be one of those kids, and I was just like, he's called Power Man. It just seemed a little strange to me to have. God bless Robin and all the and Bucky and all those early 40s sidekicks. But it's like if you're letting a 12-year-old run around while you're being shot at by gangsters, you're a dick. I'm sorry, you're an irresponsible asshole, and I have no fucking sympathy for you. So it's like I'm not gonna. It's one thing if this kid's like a high schooler or a teenager, someone who can sort of basically is very close enough to being an adult to make his own decisions. But if you know. But kid sidekicks,
that's legal. That's child age. Where you stop being a dick and just become irresponsible when you're letting them 16. If it's a 16-year-old running out, it's okay.
You're old enough to drive. You're old enough to be Robin.
That works for me. All right. Brett, please.
The X-Men is different because they're a team of teenagers, and so they're all encouraging each other's terrible behavior. So I don't have a problem with that.
Yeah, I can see that.
How about Power Pack? Their entire team's like 12 and.
Well, again, they're all siblings. I wrote Power Pack also.
Which is awesome.
No, I love Power Pack. I was at Gary Harvard. Those guys are geniuses. And you guys should all pick up the Last Airbender comics to do for Dark Horse. Those are two middle-aged Japanese ladies, and they're fucking geniuses.
Yeah.
Working with them was awesome. Doing Power Pack, I love Power Pack.
Nice.
Well, see, because they were always trying to hide it from their parents, so that was that seems reasonable.
Yeah, exactly. They weren't, you know, it's not like Bruce Wayne, who has all the resources of God, is like, you know, sure, I'll let you come get shot at with me. This will be fun.
So if there was a Marvel character that you would most super duper like to write, which one is it?
I kind of did all of them. I mean, the only one I didn't do that much of that I was a huge fan of was Doctor Strange, but I don't really have a burning. Like, just because I'm a fan of thing doesn't necessarily mean I want to write it.
Yeah, so, well, like, I mean, you wrote all of this, or, like, so many zombie book too. You probably, yeah.
Those are a lot of different, and I put all, like, all the horror characters I love, like Man-Thing and Morbius and Jennifer Kale in there, just because I love writing those characters. And I loved,
why not?
And Spider-Man was my guy. I got to write Spider-Man forever. But, you know, when I was done, I just didn't want to do it anymore. You know, I don't know. I either have, I think I might have more of a novelist's brain or a filmmaker's brain. I really respect guys like Kirkman and Bendis who can just write hundreds of issues of things. Like, I lose interest after like 20. You know, I'm like, I've said what I want to say. Like, okay, let's go to the next thing, you know. So, I'm never going to be writing, you know, I mean, famous last words, I guess, but I don't really see myself ever writing 100 issues of X, you know.
Yeah. Well, that brings up an interesting question then, is how do you plot things? Like, do you plot things out just along, like, 4-issue story arcs? Do you go through, like, 10 issues?
Yeah, I mean, generally, the publisher gives you sort of a framework of how they want to kind of trade it, and that really sort of ends up being how you do it. My buddy Charles Soule has this great process, particularly in things like Swamp Thing, where he does things he does more short stories. But I kind of, I for whatever reason, have not really gotten into that with comics, just because I do sort of tend to think sort of more novelistically, so I need a little bit more air to do a beginning, middle, and an end. So yeah, it's more of a, particularly with something like Archer and Armstrong, it's interesting because with Archer Armstrong, that's much more sort of, you know, the trades and the arcs of these kind of specific units. Magnus, on the other hand, is actually being done in terms of a season. So there's actually, it's a bit broader of a brush we're using to tell something like Magnus.
Let's get into Magnus. Let's stop beating around the bush here. Let's get into Magnus. Enough. Yeah, I mean, enough of you just entertaining us with all these great stories of your life. Let's get into what the meat of the story of what we're here to do. Talk Magnus, because the new Magnus is coming out from Dynamite. So again, how does this occur? Did they approach you? What's your initial thoughts upon it? How much do you know about Magnus and that type of thing?
I am old enough to have actually bought Magnus off the rack, because Western Publishing reprinted those original Gold Key comics ad infinitum. So like in the late 70s, when I was 7 or 8, you could actually buy what would be today be called like a trade paperback collection, like 100-page, because it was like, you know, it was like on cheap newsprint. You bought it in the magazine racks.
I love those.
Grocery store. Yeah. So I bought those. I remember reading this. I bought a Magnus, I had a Spectre, and I had a Solar, the Gold Key comics. For whatever reason, there was no Turok. And I really, really dug Magnus. And having reread the entire Gold Key run to sort of set this up, those Russ Manning stories, the artwork and the designs, and it's, you know, it's clearly written for 10-year-olds, and it's terrific. But it's great 10-year-old, you know, literature for 10-year-olds. It's really cleverly done sort of science fiction adventure. And I just happened to be going out with my buddy Nick Cosby, who is the Marvel editor who put me and Greg together first on Hercules. And we did a lot of things together in my career. And Dynamite had, he's since left Marvel, and Dynamite had tapped in to edit these books. And so he, because I was working at Valiant, he knew nothing about the Gold Key characters, and he knew there was that Valiant connection, so he wanted to know what I knew about them. And just during the course of the conversation, I was like, well, you know, I mean, some of these characters, some material is kind of challenging, but then we sort of, through the back and forth, I started talking more and more about how I would do Magnus. And kind of by the end of the evening, we had the whole kind of concept, the new concept for Magnus kind of laid out. So that's really sort of how I ended up doing this, was just by sheer, it's one part luck. You know, it's a lot, you know, a lot of life is both who you know and luck kind of combining, and that was definitely the case here.
Yeah, so somebody who is completely unfamiliar with Magnus, tell them who Magnus the Robot Fighter is, and then tell us who your Magnus Robot Fighter is.
Sure. Well, Magnus is a series set in the far future in which robots have pretty much dominated human society. The difference between the original Gold Key and to a lesser extent the Valiant Magnus and my Magnus is that previously in the Gold Key and Valiant versions of Magnus, robots were helping humanity. It was very much the Isaac Asimov vision of robots, and that they were tools in helping humanity, but every once in a while evil people or evil robots would show up and Magnus would have to show up and beat them up. It was almost sort of a, you read those, the 60s Gold Key comics, and they're almost, and I'm curious if how much Russ Manning was sort of influenced by Ayn Rand, because there's a lot of, like, you know, pseudo-libertarian, you're depending too much on technology, you're depending too much on the state, and Magnus is this virile, you know, heroic figure coming in to sort of put everybody straight. My series takes a bit of a different tack. It incorporates developments in cybernetics and artificial intelligence and a lot of concepts that really have developed even since Valiant did their Magnus revival in the 90s, in which robots have completely taken over humanity, supposedly for humankind's own good, and Magnus is trying to liberate humans from robots, and it bears pointing out that many humans don't really feel like they need to be liberated. They rather like the robot regime. So the political slant of our series is a bit different than the original version, where Magnus is seen by the regime. In the original, Magnus is sort of seen as a superhero. In our version, he's seen more of as a vigilante and a terrorist. So it's sort of the difference between Superman and Batman, right? You know, the cops always sort of view Spider-Man and Batman with suspicion, but Superman, you know, is beloved by all. So that's sort of the difference.
Now, I have a kind of a two-pronged question, because we've read a lot of, well, almost all the Valiants. And so did you go into the Valiant at all? I don't know how much you're able to use from the Valiant, if any, or if you would even bother.
I think in theory we're allowed to use everything from the Valiant run, because that's all owned by the licensor, which in this instance, I don't know if this is general knowledge, but after several corporate parents, DreamWorks currently owns all those characters. So we're actually working very closely with DreamWorks Pictures to develop these characters into the comics, and they are there and going to develop them for various, you know, video games, movies, whatever it is that they want to do with them. So I actually have not read the Valiant stuff. Dinesh, who runs the current version of Valiant, was telling me that Magnus, he actually kind of, we had dinner in Albuquerque, New Mexico at a Comic-Con, and he sort of gave me the rundown of the Valiant Magnus, because that was his favorite comic. Was the Valiant Magnus. So I've read the entire Gold Key series. I've not read any of the Valiant series.
Okay. So that means you also didn't read any of the Acclaim.
That is correct. I did read the four issues that came out under Dark Horse, the Jim Shooter.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Well, those are more similar in tone, certainly, to the Valiant. And the Acclaim, it's good that
they definitely felt like they were continuing a pre-existing story.
Yeah. If you felt those are, yeah, similar tone. And the Acclaim ones are just awful.
I'm glad you haven't read it.
Acclaim ones, okay. I
would recommend the Valiant ones, absolutely. The Acclaim ones, I would say, you know, because I like you, don't read them.
Ah!
Yeah, well, because most importantly, I don't want anything that you could possibly read from those influence your current Magnus take.
Well, I mean, the Valiant one, you're...
Tell me, why was it so bad? Well, because I'm not going to read them. What did you object to?
The only thing that's an improvement is the costume. I never really liked the gi type thing personally.
The short pants?
Yeah, I never really.
Offense.
Yeah. I always found that a little strange. But, you know, the costume is better. But this is not. I mean, first off, he's just an asshole. He's just a very angry man, you know?
Right.
Very aggressive. His origin is completely taken away. You know, the characters, none of the characters are transplanted. Everything is so completely fresh that the idea that he's called, sometimes called Russ and sometimes called Magnus. And he fights robots and was raised by a robot, though that robot is an evil robot who kind of is, I don't know, got a strange, dark sense of humor.
He's called
Russ in the Acclaim Magnus?
Yes. Yeah, he's often called Russ, sometimes called Magnus.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Interesting. Although totally understandable.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, he's just, like I say, I mean, other than he fights robots, and he's raised by a robot. And he doesn't even really fight robots as much as you'd think he would.
You know what he does? He spends most of his time traveling.
Yeah. It's true. It's the name, the book is called Magnus Robot Fighter. It opens up every issue and you'd see MFR Magnus Robot Fighter, or MRF.
I think I've seen
And then you'd wait to the part where he fights the robot, thinking this should happen. It said it right there. That's the name of the damn book.
I'm sure.
He actually did fight robot versions of the presidents.
That was awesome.
Nice.
Although
every president, and the presidents were, it was hilarious because they were robot versions of all the presidents of the United States up until Clinton, and especially Nixon couldn't stop swearing like F bombs out of. It was incredible.
Sounds like the greatest comic ever. I don't know why you.
Well, actually, you know, the more and as I'm about to say that, you know, it ends on a cliffhanger, with featuring him basically. Let's see now. What did he wind up doing? He wound up infiltrating essentially Disneyland.
Yeah.
Sure. Well.
Yeah, but it's called Woozyland, I think.
Yeah. So, I mean. You know, the more that you mention it, maybe I should reread.
Look,
it.
Look, if you like Ed Wood films, maybe this is for you. But if you like Magnus and you want something that pisses on it and would be offended by that, don't read it. But if you just want
was it even set in the future?
No.
Well, no, it was
sort of
because
he time travels.
Yeah, because he came back in time and then he.
Oh, he's like a reverse Terminator. Yeah, I get it. That's. Concept. He's a human coming back in time to beat up the robots.
Yeah, before they become. Yeah, exactly.
Fair enough. Still sounds kind of lame.
So anyways, if you want to take some of that, you know, go ahead. And I'm sure that's pretty close to where you are going.
Totally. Yeah. If 1A was going to become a sociopath, then totally.
One of the ideas, and it sort of comes across the first issue, one of the initial ideas we had was be the idea that he's the only guy who can tell robots from humans. It's sort of more set in the present where it's almost sort of a they live scenario where there are all these hidden robots everywhere. And I just sort of ended up projecting that because it's kind of like what schizophrenics do. Like, you're a robot. Like, I wouldn't want anybody like stabbing anyone.
But that reminds me that's another thing that they really screwed with. Instead of being, you know, trained by a robot, like I believe in the Gold Key, he's trained by, and I've read so many Magnus, sometimes it rolls together, but I recollect in Gold Key, he's trained from the youth, into the martial arts by the robot, and that's what hardens his skin to the point where he can fight robots.
They don't. That's never
explained. No? Okay. All right. Maybe that was a Valiant thing, because in Valiant, he was the son of a Harbinger.
To explain it.
He was the son of a Harbinger who had been shot back in time and during the Unity.
He's actually the son of Torque and Flamingo.
Yes. Okay. In this one, the robot that he's given, he's infused him with like liquid robot.
Well, kind of like a Terminator, kind of like.
Yeah, he's like Magnus he's got like this liquid, living liquid inside of him.
You know, actually,
robot liquid.
The more that we talk about it out loud, the more that it makes no sense, but complete sense for the time.
Like the more I'm going, man, that's awful. But I'm starting to really actually appreciate it because I'm starting to see the insanity of this thing. Yeah, he's got like living liquid robot. Being and like, so if he gets shot, he'll bring him back.
This is the Acclaim one.
Yeah. This is the Acclaim one.
I feel like we're talking too much about the
I think so.
Shitty Acclaim version, not my awesome
dialogue. No, yours was, and we say thank you very much for the preview copy, because we did read it, and we really both enjoyed it. One of the things that, that I think has been a challenge for writers of both for Valiant and also in Gold Key, I think there's some of this, is simply because it's set in the future. You have a very sanitized society, and therefore the characters can be hard to relate to because everything's so sanitized, the characters and the society and everything like that. So how do you kind of combat that idea?
Well, that's a great question, because I mean, that was something that's sort of where this all sort of, you know, we spend about 7 or 8 pages setting up Magnus and making him someone you care about and someone that, you know, isn't just, you know, has some weird racism against robots and wants to punch them. Yeah, so you know, the first part of the story takes place in a mountain town called Morey's Peak, where robots and humans live in sort of perfect harmony. And that was done by I was inspired by a great Scandinavian illustrator whose name eludes me, and a lot of his paintings I sort of were inspired. He did a great series about integrating humans and robots in this really kind of bucolic setting that was really neat. And so it was sort of the big inspiration for me and Corey Smith, the artist. And then you sort of get dumped into Northam, which is this highly regulated robot city where what you learn as the series goes through is that the robots have a religion. And the robot religion is that their purpose for existing is to be better humans than humans are. They're supposed to be perfect copies. And so a lot of that, you'll see permutations of that. And that's sort of the simple idea for the society. And you'll see the various implications of that going forward as the series go forward. So then there's lots of mysteries. And how did this society get this way? And what happened to all the other humans? And were they all murdered? Like, what happened to the other robots and all this stuff? And so there's a lot of mysteries that are sort of being unraveled as the series goes along. And you'll definitely get more of that in the next couple issues. The whole sort of way I wanted to open the series was to make Magnus a dude, like a guy that you could relate to, because I did know that, you know, this is something Dinesh told me actually about the shooter Magnus, is that he was also kind of a douchebag, kind of this alpha male overbearing personality. And certainly in the Gold Key Magnus, when he first shows up, 1A literally drops him out of the sky and he starts punching robots. And he's like, I can show you a better way to live, you know? And no one wants to be around a guy like that. Like, that's really annoying. That's like your, you know, your weird right-wing uncle, you know, Thanksgiving. He's always giving you a hard time.
Yeah, I think his mission was basically punch robots, save Legia.
Right, yes. And then Legia obviously is another huge component of this, and she's totally different. This is the most unconventional treatment of Legia in Magnus history, just because... and this is something that I sort of explored with when Tom Fallon and I did that Hulk season one graphic novel. We made Betty a soldier and an MP and actually gave her sort of a role. And we wanted to make Legia a major character as opposed to just, you know, the love interest. So she's a human hunter. She hunts down stray humans for robots.
That was one of the things I actually really appreciated, was at the end we see Legia, and because I wasn't sure, certainly kind of also with the setup earlier, if we would see her at all, if she would be a part of it.
What's funny is I didn't look at the proof. If you go back, the Times Square scene is there's a huge billboard for her reality TV show right behind Magnus.
Oh, really? I missed that.
Corey very cleverly slipped that in.
Too cleverly for me. So, I have to...
Me too. It took me like 7 readings. I think it was right before the book went to press.
I really liked his pencils as well. What else has Corey done? Do you know?
Corey's a terrific artist that the editor, Nate Cosby, found through Twitter. So
really?
Join Twitter listening to this. Uh-huh.
He actually does that a lot because I do follow him.
He does. Yep. Corey's best known. He's done a lot of Fathom for Aspen.
Mm-hmm.
And he's done a lot of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles for IDW.
I really liked his work here. But so Legia shows up right at the end. And of course, as you mentioned, you wanted to make her... And she's a character that... that I think was not... they tried with Valiant to make her more likable. They tried with Valiant to make her more tougher in some points, but they also, right at the beginning, she was the shallowest character ever under Jim Shooter, actually.
Well, so, he just carried on from from the originals.
But almost. He made her even more shallow, yeah. I think. Yeah, just, you know, somebody who was just there to be the damsel in distress. So, right. I mean, this is... Where are we going to see with Leisure? Give us a little hint without giving us too much.
Well, I mean, Leisure's always been the daughter of Senator Klain. She was in Gold Key, and she is in Valiant, and she is in this series. Senator Klain's role is slightly different because North Am is a theocracy. It's not a democracy. It's run by the Church of Singularity. And so Senator Klain serves on this synod, which is a sort of a fancy term for a church legislature. And the robots all worship this, all follow this Church of the Singularity. The singularity, the famous singularity that the founder of Google keeps talking about, which happens in 2045, according to him, has happened in Magnus. And as we roll out, and it sounds like there may be a Magnus Zero, where we go into this even more, is sort of it's the bridge between the future of Earth that you see in the beginning of Magnus with Maury's Peak and gets us to North Am in the future where robots went from being subservient to humans to humans being subservient to robots. And why, you know, I mean, it also sort of begs the question of why do robots even need humans? Robots are immortal and they're super strong and they're invulnerable. Why do we need humans? And the answer is humans give robots a reason to exist in much the same way that God and our gods give us as humans reasons to exist.
That's interesting. That's an interesting concept.
Yeah, except that robots, you know, it's like imagine if you were created by God and now you have God on the leash. And are leading him around, or you have him on your desk.
You know, I know we were going to stop with the Acclaim, but did we mention that the robots in that one like to can human beings and eat them as meat? And just throwing it out there.
Yeah,
just
they had a religion too, but there's involved eating humans.
Is this the Acclaim?
They canned human beings and ate them as meat, and human beings would eat this meat not knowing they were eating other humans. Did I mention you got to read
Sorry,
this?
Guys,
you
you're
have
really,
to read this series.
You're really selling this to me. This still sounds like the greatest comic of all time.
You have to read this all of a sudden.
Well, you know,
I appreciate it a little more.
Let's just set a date. You can read it, and then we'll come back and
get a review. That would be amazing.
All right, we'll do a follow-up. Oh,
that would be incredible. Yes.
Oh, that is brilliant. Yeah. All right, so I'm just gonna go on to something completely different. I'm gonna like do it 90 degrees. So,
but I still had other questions.
You did?
Yeah.
Awkward.
So I'll take back over there just because he's gonna go off and let me That's just right. Just before you do that, just the other Western publishing characters. So how tightly are we gonna see this universe kind of wound together? Because I mean that's one thing the Valiant certainly did, but. I mean, I know there is a Dr. Occult and Solar and Turok, of course. Those are the other three characters, correct, from Dynamite?
Dr. Spectre.
Oh, Dr. Spectre. Yeah. What did I say? Dr. Occult?
Occult.
My mistake. So Dr. Spectre. So these are the other characters. How tightly are we going to see them kind of wound together?
Very tightly.
Yeah.
More I probably can't say, but very tightly.
Okay. That's good enough. Well, then, I really didn't need to ask that question, did I? But I interrupted you anyways, Brett.
That's fair. That's totally fair. All right. So now, given some of your other work, if there were celebrities that you'd actually want to see on Survival Extreme, like real celebrities, which ones would they be?
Okay. Is that a reference to G.I. Joe number 6? The cover girl origin in which she appeared in Survival?
Yes.
You know, you just got to throw it. Celebrities seem like... fairly normal people for the most part. I mean, I guess you could sort of round up the craziest ones you get your hands on, you know? Like,
come on, you gotta want to put Dennis Rodman on that thing, right?
Well, sure. I don't know, the really crazy celebrities, I gotta be honest with you, the really crazy celebrities just seem kind of sad to me. So, like, I don't, like, have any desire to see them tortured. I guess I don't really have a desire to see anybody tortured, so just I cannot, let me just put it this way.
I have a desire to see us tortured if you read that Acclaim Magnus.
I can't, well, there's that. But I can't imagine actually ever watching Survival Extreme for any reason, even though I created it. Just because it seems really obnoxious. It just, I don't like any of those those extreme game shows. Like I guess Amazing Race is sort of okay, but they just kind of bore me, to be honest with you. So but
when you're doing this, then is it cathartic? You're like, I get this out of my system. I hate this, and I'm not sure it to be as ridiculous as I really seem.
My attitude when I was writing the GI was when I was writing the IDW GI Joe was I was going to take all the file cards and that Larry Hama wrote for the back of the figures and take all those literally. like that was the only canon was the file cards. So I did a Duke origin GI Joe 3 and he has dialogue the exact same as what's on his file card. And so Courtney Krieger covered those, file card says she was a model. And so you kind of have to sort of wrap your brain around why would a internationally famous supermodel join this elite military organization? And so that's where that story came from. I don't know if it made it up to Canada, but there was a very briefly here, this terrible reality show, Stars with Stripes or something like that, where it was like celebrities who actually, it was literally Survival Extreme. Not literally, but it was like, it was Z-list celebrities, being forced to do boot camp and basically be military guys. And we laugh at them at their bumbling and, shooting each other in the butt or whatever it is that they ended up, whatever the appeal of the show was. So that's sort of where that kind of came from, was this idea of, well, how can I get, why would I, Courtney Krieger, want to give up the glamorous life of a supermodel and become commando, essentially? And that's where that issue came from.
Yeah, because she realizes that she likes to, or that she's good at killing people.
Yeah. She really likes killing people.
Natural killing people.
It's way more fun than, sitting on your ass waiting to, have your photograph taken.
it's interesting because the original Hama G.I. Joe series is one of the reasons why I love comics so much. Sure. And so, when I saw that you had the new series coming out, I was very excited, but... So you had to, how does that work between Larry Hama writing the real American hero portion and then the other side of the IDW? Like, did you just have to take from that IDW side?
Right. Yeah. Larry's been given his own universe. And essentially what Larry's doing is a continuation of his Marvel comic. That's supposed to be just a continuous thing.
Yeah.
So Larry has his own sort of OG G.I. Joe, OG G.I. Joe, or is that OGI Joe? Anyway, he has his own little pocket universe, and then the other IDW stuff, all, my Costas Cobra series and Chuck Dixon's run and all my stuff, that's all in its own little pocket universe as well.
So is there any characters that you wish that you could have written into your book?
Well, I mean, not to sound sour grapes, but if you're being given G.I. Joe, it would have been nice to have Snake Eyes and Scarlet. Mm-hmm.
I had that feeling just when I read it because, Snake Eyes pops down. Ha ha, it's Quick Kick and Snake Eyes.
Right. Yeah, that was Steve Kerr's idea. Yeah, so I sort of made Quick Kick. It's something of a Snake Eyes clone, and then I used CoverGirl because...
As opposed to that Bruce Lee clone he was originally. Yeah.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Well, yeah, because when the Snake Eyes character started talking, I did have this like sudden violent reaction because I haven't read that many IDWs.
That was Steve Kurtz's whole idea. That was literally the only reason he did that was the talking thing. Which, although I think he ripped that off of the G.I. Joe Retaliation movie because Storm Shadow at one point dresses up like Snake Eyes.
Have you ever had the chance to talk to Larry Hama about his creative process of writing G.I. Joe?
Yeah, I was very fortunate when the IDW number one came out to do a signing with him, and that was a lovely. That was one of my all time favorite afternoons ever.
Yeah, we had a chance to talk to him, and
I like G.I. Joe, but what I love is his Wolverine run.
And same thing. We had a chance to talk to him, listen to him talk. Really, it was more like, and he just told us, I wrote them issue to issue, and I couldn't remember what I did the last issue. So I'd go back and go, oh, that's the trouble I got myself into. Now, how do I get myself out of this issue? That was how he – not exactly long-term plotting, which is fascinating to me.
It's not Jonathan Hickman with a little notebook.
No.
No, that's for sure.
No.
Do you see – will you ever come back to G.I. Joe, or is that pretty much a closed book?
Probably not. I mean, the situation with G.I. Joe ended up being – I loved working for IDW, and Hasbro was very supportive. It was all terrific, but I really did what I wanted to do with the characters the first couple arcs. And then was sort of a third arc I was going to do that was going to bring back the original Adventure Time – Adventure Team – group, which you saw that because Joe, because Bullet Man showed up in the Survival Dream story, and so I was sort of seeding that, but really I did everything I wanted to do in the first two arcs, and I should be honest with you, what happened was I got Magnus.
Interesting.
I really wanted to do Magnus, and I just wouldn't have had time to do Magnus if I had continued with G.I. Joe.
So you're saying you can't write 20 books a month? Is that?
It seems like you can. I gotta admit. You see,
It's not only 20 books a month. What it is it takes the average artist 6 to 7 weeks to do a book, and it takes me about a week to write a book. So I can do. It's not technically a month, you know, if you go by the lunar calendar, but it is like, you know, you can't do like 6 or 7 books a month. And so the situation really was, I'm at about 5 or 6 right now. So yeah, I kind of had to slot out, G.I. Joe in order to do Magnus. I also did legitimately feel when I hit about issue 9 or 10 on G.I. Joe that I'd done everything that I wanted to do with the character. So it better to have fresh blood in there than sort of have me spinning my wheels trying to figure out, you know, than me going back past issues, God bless Larry Hama, but me going back past issues going, oh shit, what am I going to do now? It's not really how I like
it. I can't believe it.
It's very stressful.
You should have seen the look on all our faces when he's explaining to us, this is how he did it. I don't remember what I wrote. So I went and looked at the last couple pages and went, oh, I'm in trouble here. I'm going to get out of it. Like, that's it. That's all the long-term. I blew my mind. I have a couple questions here for you.
We did signing at this lovely store, the comic shop in Wilmington, Delaware, run by this lovely couple, Sarah and Titus, and they took us out for dinner that night. And Larry's like, oh, I'm not a writer. I just sit down. I just visualize in my head, and then I write it down. I'm like, Larry, that's what a writer does. What are you talking about? Like, he it's adorable because he wants to be more of a curmudgeon than he really is.
Now, do you wish, okay, this was actually a different question, but don't you wish you could have written Sergeant Slaughter while you're at it? Isn't that something that's, come on.
You know, that's something that came up a lot with the Joe fans. I really have no connection to that character, and obviously they can't get the rights to him, which is why I couldn't write him. I mean, I would have liked to have put him in, obviously, the Survival Extreme issue.
Yeah, great.
But, and Jamal Igle, very close friend of mine who drew that issue, was a huge era of that G.I. Joe fan. He desperately wanted to do Sergeant Slaughter, but...
Yes. I also did We Talk Wrestling as long as I just had to bring out Sergeant Slaughter, right? But
nothing against Sergeant Slaughter.
Yeah. Let's go through. Give me, what's the average day in a life like Fred Van Lent? Lenty. See, I knew I was going to get wrong.
Fair enough. Well, I try to be at my, you know, I wake up and have breakfast like most people. I sit down at my desk and in my computer and screw around on the internet for too long, like most people. But you know, I try to keep it 9 to 5. I try to work 5 days a week. I try to not work on the weekends. Recently, the not working weekends in part has not really worked out very well for me. Yeah, you know, I mean, I've always been kind of a homebody. I work out of my apartment in Brooklyn. We have a 2-bedroom and 1-bedroom dedicated home office for me. My wife has her own office elsewhere in the apartment. But it's, you know, it's not very dramatic, you know. Work until lunch, eat lunch, work until dinner, eat dinner, go do something after dinner, you know, go to sleep. That's pretty much my life. You know, I go to a lot more, you know, comic conventions in strange places than regular people, but
how about that's about promotion it. Of books like Magnus and your other projects? Oh.
Well, it's very exciting. For Magnus, I'm going to be doing a lot of signings. This Saturday, I don't know when this episode will go up.
Probably
but
tomorrow.
In Tampa. Cool. Well, this Saturday, I will be in Tampa, Florida from 2 to 6 at Heroes Haven. That's the 15th. Next 22nd in Virginia, I'll be at Game On. The weekend after that, I will be in Emerald City Comic Con in Seattle. I think we mentioned that earlier. And... I'll be back at the comic shops in Wilmington at some point in April to sign Conan the Avenger. I'm the new writer on Conan, so they'll be coming out next month.
Oh, really?
And I'll be signing at some point at Jim Haley's Universe for that as well. We just have to coordinate those two dates.
Who's doing the art on the Conan?
It's Brian Ching, who's doing a wonderful job. I just got the color proof this weekend. It looks terrific.
All right, so another question for you is, is it just on your bucket list to work for every single comic book company, or...
I kind of have. I don't know what I don't quite. I guess I haven't worked for Fantagraphics or
Oni.
Oni yet. I've done Arcade or Boom, but I've worked for IDW, Valiant, Dark Horse, DC, Marvel. Got my start at Caliber. I've done Image Comics. I have an Image book coming out this summer with Tom Fowler, How Tunes. It's a great YA book. Teaching kids rudimentary science and energy literacy, and all part of a surviving in a post-apocalyptic environment, which really we all need that. That
is absolutely.
But yeah, I'm well traveled. Dynamite, I forgot Dynamite through Magnus. So
yeah, that's something else.
You got to work for Boom. Those are good guys.
Cool. Yeah. No, I think I'm Boom guys. That's true. Boom and RK, I guess, are now the same company.
Yeah, that's right. No, we'll hook you up.
That's
you're,
right.
You're welcome.
We know folks. Yeah.
Because you're not getting enough work on your own.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
No.
Staring at the walls.
Just a couple of random podcasters. We'll hook you right up.
Yeah. Ah, why not?
Gothic Council, guys.
All right. Well, you ready to move on to some Archer and Armstrong? I'm ready to move on. How about you, Mo?
I'd love to talk a few minutes of Archer and Armstrong. We can just get a couple more minutes with you, Fred.
Yeah, is that all right?
The True Detective finale is in 25 minutes, so you have about 20 minutes.
Okay, fair enough. So, Archer and Armstrong. Now, I'm a huge fan of the Barry Windsor Smith Archer and Armstrong.
It was wonderful.
So, how much did you try to carry on with that? Did you go through, I assume you went through and read, there's only 25 issues, so it's not too hard. How much?
Only 12, which were only 13 of which or so were done by.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
before Mark Baron took over. And not as many good things to say personally.
Yeah. He had a different vision for the
series. That's for sure.
So Wearly, where is your vision for the series?
In my ass! No.
Fair enough.
To Valiant's credit, I read this stuff and it just is nuts. You know, it's super awesome. It looks beautiful, but it's insane. And so I didn't really know quite what to do with it. So my first outline for the first issue was really just kind of a straight-up remake of the first issue of the Archer and Armstrong run. But they sort of encouraged me to change it up a bit. It was Warren Simon's idea to have this sort of gracious theme park. The 1% were always part of my original pitch. I mean, really what the book is about, and to a certain extent it's what Incredible Hercules was about, the book is about religion. The book is about, because really what, the book is so mired in conspiracy theories, and what conspiracy theories really are, I like to say, they're the mythology of the impotent. They're people, they're projections of people who don't have power about how power operates. So all conspiracy theories end up trying to be a unified theory if you're explaining why things the way they are. And so the book in that sense is sort of about the spiritual evolution of Archer, of Obadiah Archer, with Armstrong kind of trying to help him out. And that's sort of where the book has kind of come from the very beginning. We did religious conspiracies, historical conspiracies now. Once we end the Bloodshot crossover, we're going to do entertainment conspiracies with this arc called American Wasteland. And really it's about exploring and making fun of a lot of these sort of conceits people have about the way, the world actually works. We did a Faraway arc that was all about mysterious disappearances. So it's Archer and Armstrong trying to sort of make their way through the world and make sense of it. Through other people's sort of insane interpretations about how the world actually works.
Now, again, going back to the Barry Windsor Smith one, was a different pace than most comic books we read. That was one of the things I really appreciated about it, but very funny. And Mike Baron's was a little bit more silly, and therefore often not as funny for me. And I found your book very funny. But how do you kind of find that balance? Where do you find the balance when you're how much do people say to you, this is really funny, and therefore you think I need to do more funny, or do you think, okay, let's keep this balance? How do you kind of go about that?
Well, you sort of, I mean, it's all rooted in the characters and the situations. I think the key really is, I mean, I think the problem with the Baron run is that he didn't really know, and certainly with all due respect, I don't see that Smith necessarily knew what the point was. You know, I mean, Shooter did this essay in the collection of the Barry Windsor Smith, Archer Armstrong's that New Valiant put out, where he said that they came up with the book because they felt like they needed a buddy book, which didn't really make. Which I guess because he edited, you know, I guess Power by Iron Fist was the buddy book over at Marvel. He sort of said it in such a way that sort of made it seem like it was, of course we need to have buddy books. Like, it's not really that common of a comic. You know, I've written a couple of very famous ones, but it's not like that's the most common comics genre, superhero genre. As long as it's like jazz, you know, that you can improv all you want in jazz as long as you have this melody and this bass line that you keep coming back to. And for Archer Armstrong, what we're constantly riffing on is this idea of faith and belief and conspiracy. And as long as we don't stray too far from that, or at least as long as we come back to it in the end, as far as I'm concerned, anything's game.
So how much control then do you have to do the storylines that you want to? Because we talked about earlier about how editors, you know, have their say in it now. And I know that you're doing the Bloodshot crossover. So was that kind of...
Right.
Put upon you to do, or was that kind
of
an idea?
No, quite the opposite. In fact, I actually just pitched that out as an Archer and Armstrong storyline that I would just write and we just do it in Archer and Armstrong. And I was thrilled when Valiant decided to do it where we cross over the two books, because I had been building this idea that Archer was a member, was a kid in Project Rising Spirit nursery from the fourth issue. And so it was just sort of a natural conflict. We had Ivar on a pod of the Time Walker, foreshadowed that would happen in the Faraway arc. So it all kind of came together very nicely, and it was cool.
Now, again, Eternal Warrior first shows up in your Archer and Armstrong before getting his own series, and he has a different personality than one of Valiant. So again, do they come to you? Do they kind of give you some guidelines? How much freedom is there for you kind of with these characters?
You know, Eternal Warrior is a very important character for Valiant, so they definitely were kind of over my shoulder with that. But I mean, Gillett is for me a very kind of straightforward character. He's basically you know, the Punisher meets Highlander is kind of how I wrote him, as this kind of relentless force of nature. So that wasn't that big of a deal. But no, these people, the Valiant folks, you know, this company was bought by Valiant fans. They very much see themselves as stewards and caretakers of these properties, and that's sort of where they're coming from with everything. But you know, for the most part, Archer Armstrong is a sort of unique vision I've been allowed to cultivate, and I'm very grateful for that.
And you say usually you have about 20 issues. How long you got left with Archer and Armstrong? You've been there since the beginning. I'm hoping for
a while.
Not
too much longer. I feel like I've, you know, particularly with the Bloodshot crossover, most of the stuff I've seeded early on is coming to fruition, and more of it, you'll see more of that coming rapidly.
So what else from the Valiant universe? What characters have you not had a chance then to work with that you think, oh, I want to do something with that character?
Oh, I like Dr. Mirage. I like a lot of female characters. I'd like to do more with Geomancer, Kay McHenry, who we created in Archer Armstrong. She's probably the person I would like the most.
I love that you guys gave us a female Geomancer.
Yeah, thank you. No, I really love that character, and I want to do more with her, and I hope I get the opportunity. I want to do more with Ivar, who is a fun time-traveling character, and I would love to do a Time Walker book. That would probably be my absolute most favorite thing to do.
So now we were talking to Robert Venditti a little while ago, and so of course he writes Exo Manowar, and Mo over here at the time. So we're talking to Robert Venditti.
I told him this off the air.
Oh, you already told him off the air. All right, yeah.
I heard the story.
I'm ruining the story. I already ruined it. I tell for everybody else that hasn't heard.
Well, and just Mo coming up and saying, like, well, you know, I like Exo Manowar, but I'm a really big fan of Archer and Armstrong. You know, that's a funny, funny book right there.
Yeah, it's like my favorite series. And he's, you know, the thing is, he agreed that the problem was that it wasn't written by you, you know. He said, yeah, it'd probably be better to. He agreed. He's a nice fella. So
Robert has a great story where he was vacationing with his family in Las Vegas, I think, and they went into a comic store, and his family egged him on to go tell the clerk that he was the writer of Exo Manowar. This, I think, before he got the Green Lantern, the DC books, and he says, yeah, hey, I'm Robert Bendita, right? X-Men War. And the guy goes, oh, yeah, I really like X-Men War, but it doesn't sell very well here. We do really well in Shadow Man. That's when you never try to pull your weight in the comic book stores. You'll get humbled. You'll get humbled faster than you know it.
All right, and I think we probably have taken enough of your time. We really appreciate it, but just one last thing. I have one question before we go here, then one last question for the uninitiated like myself. What's True Detective?
Oh, seriously?
Well,
no idea.
True Detective,
wow.
True Detective is a television program on the HBO down south, down here, and it is a mystery series starring Matthew McConaughey and Woody Harrelson. It's very well done. The writer is a self-avowed fan of Alan Moore and Grant Morrison. That's where he got a lot of his inspiration from. It's a kind of a Cthulhu mythos-influenced murder mystery, although there's nothing overtly supernatural in the show. It's only 8 episodes long. It's a case per season. So tonight's episode, which is starting in 15 minutes... is the 8th and final episode of the season, and will be the 8th and final episode we ever see these characters.
All right.
And so, assuming they do a second season, it will be a brand new mystery with brand new detectives and a brand new location,
now,
so on and so forth.
What do you think?
I like it quite a bit.
Oh, go ahead.
I was just gonna say I like it quite a bit.
Okay, what do you think of the idea then of next season? It's starring you, me, and Brett as the detectives.
Love it. Let's do it.
Do it.
What's
awesome.
The
book it to somebody.
Are we doing Jaywalkers, the shoplifting, or?
Ben Diddy, we can put him in there too.
Art.
What are we detecting?
Art theft. I like art theft. You know.
Oh, I like art theft. That's a very specialized field. I'm a fan of that.
Good stuff.
Totally awesome. All right. Have you got any last words for us?
Yeah. Plug away.
Well, I think we've hit everything. Magnus obviously comes out on March 12th. Alberto picks that up and digs it. Conan comes, I believe, third week of April. And then How Tunes, the image book, shows up in June. And, of course, keep reading Archer and Armstrong. And pick up the Free Comic Book Day from Dark Horse Comics, Free Comic Book Day book. I wrote that. It's called Project Black Sky. It's opening up a whole new world for the Dark Horse superhero characters, and I hope you dig it.
That's true. We didn't even talk about Brain Boy. Holy crap. I guess you're going to have to come back on again.
Not a problem.
You're going to come back on. We're going to talk some Acclaimed Magnus.
Sounds good. I'll read the Acclaimed Magnus and I'll act it out for
you. That'll be the greatest.
We'll definitely do a video podcast for that.
I'll totally in for that. Yeah.
I'm looking forward to it.
Cool.
Thank you, sir.
Awesome. Thanks
a lot, guys.
Red Van Lente.
Have a great night, guys.
Thank you.
You too.
Take care.